the engine cut. I was convinced that, it was both an inopportune and a stupid action. And I was bound, I was so mad that I thought when we got down at Atherton at our satellite station that I was going to beat the daylights out of this fellow. And they could court-martial me, they could do anything they wanted me, but I was so bloody mad. And when I glanced over at him, there he was rather white in the face and was on the controls with me. And we got then, the visibility wasn't too good. Anyway, we got the aircraft up to 1,000 or 1,500 feet, proceeded to Atherton, and landed, and it was fine. But he got mentioned dispatches for the event. And I didn't mind one bit, not that it mattered to me, but it was rather funny in retrospect. But at the time, it was very serious. And, you don't want to be in that kind of position. There is just a hair's breadth between piling into the ground or getting away with it. And the old Wellington was a great airplane, but it didn't have all the power in operational training. The aircraft tended to be not as well maintained. They were old, and you didn't have all of the reserves that it normally would have had if it had been a newer or a better aircraft. So that was one of the little events that sort of made life interesting.
Were there any operations that you were on that you felt were very important to the war effort besides your D-Day ones?
Well, they were all important in the sense that, you were doing was, of course, trying to destroy the enemy's capacity to produce the goods and services for their war. So from that standpoint, every operation was important. Perhaps one of the tactical experiences was when I was dispatched along with another aircraft to mine Brest Harbor. Now, this was after D-Day, and the idea was to bottle up the German naval units that were in Brest. Now, Brest was an interesting target. The Germans had a standing patrol over the city and the harbor. And of course, the U-boats used to come in there, and any other their E-boats, some of them. So the idea was to block the harbor entrance and prevent any German vessels from getting out and coming around and getting involved in the D-Day landings and the post-D-Day landings. Well, we were briefed by the Navy. They sent mining experts, a lieutenant commander, a lieutenant, and a sub-lieutenant. And we were told about the nature of the mines, the object of the exercise, the location of where we're to put these things, and something about the trip itself. Well, my bomb aimer had been dispatched to, by that time I was the flight commander, and my bomb aimer had been dispatched to a bombing leader's course, so he was away for a fortnight or more. And his place on this operation was taken by the naval sub-lieutenant. Well, we'd never met this chap until the briefing, and when we were briefed, after the briefing was finished, the group captain Brooks, was a tall South African, an older man, of course, and he stammered. And he used to get up at every briefing when the proceedings had finished, and he would sort of stammer and say, good luck, chaps. And that was his contribution. But at this particular evening, he got up and he said, now remember, and the number, rank, name only. and of course, you know, it was sort of the chill settled over the two crews. There we were, 14 of us, the Met people and all the rest were there to tell us about what life was going to be like, and the naval types. And I thought, my gosh. So we got out to the aircraft, and, you know, what were you going to do with this fellow? So I thought, well, he's naval, we'll pipe him aboard. And you had whistles that you attached to your battle dress, at least on the collar generally, so you could, if you got down in the drink room, you could try to attract attention if anybody was around. So I lined the crew up in two ranks, and got a couple of the ground crew involved too, and we piped the sub-lieutenant aboard the airplane. And the trip went very smoothly outwardly. We were to drop these mines from 15,000 feet, which was unusual. We used to do it lower. We used to do it from about 500 feet. These were parachute drogues, and you were to drop them both visually and by radar marking. And the idea was that, and the tactic was that when you dropped them, you immediately turned and started down to sea level from 15,000 feet. And of course, you had to close your bomb doors and so on. And you couldn't do that in the standard fashion, because the bomb door, the mines fairly large in diameter, and when you closed the bomb doors for takeoff, they didn't completely fit. You see, they closed the mine, but they didn't come together. See, and they rested on the mines. So, and at the same time, the hydraulic pressure to do this, the engineer had to adjust two cocks back in the middle of the aircraft and through the portholes. And he had to do this lying down and doing it by hand. And to close the bomb doors after we'd released the mines, to get full pressure, he had to open the cocks, you see. So he was doing that while I was pulling the aircraft away and going down and trying to keep the air and controlling the airspeed so I wouldn't damage the bomb doors. And we did. We dropped, turned, and were turning. And it was then that the Jerry ACAC started, and they followed us all the way down until the, you know, the depression of the guns was too low, that they couldn't get down through. Well, fortunately, they were behind us all the way, and I'm sure the other fellow was doing exactly the same thing. We were both bound and determined that we'd be the first to do it, and let the other fellow get shot up. Anyway, that was an interesting little exercise, and the rest of the flight went very normally. We came back in daylight. It was a great sight. You could see then all of the air and the daylight activities, the Americans going out, our own people. And of course, you could see it on the side as we came up the Bristol Channel way up North England. And you could see all the D-Day activity at a distance to our starboard. So that was one of the unusual flights.
Did you make any bombing operations over Germany?
Oh yes. Yeah. Oh yes. The majority of them were over Germany.
On the bombing their industrial areas,
yes,
mostly.
Yes. Places like Cologne, Duisburg, the synthetic oil plant at Sturkreide, Stuttgart, places like that. There were, of course, the other flights that were operations against the V1s in particular. And those were interesting because they were daylights. I only did two of them, three of them, I guess. The first one was the second daylight that the RAF did after they started this this campaign. Up to that time, all of our operations were at night. So that was an interesting experience because we did that on the basis of an experience that we had over one of the over a place called Montorgili. I had the wing commander, who was a most unusual man and a very and a tough leader. He was a wireless operator and the only wireless operator to command a bomber command squadron during the war. And he flew with me several times. Well, I wasn't supposed to fly when the operation was mounted, but the wing commander wanted to go, and the reason he went, wanted to go with, and why I was the one to go with, is because my wireless operator had been on leave, and he had not come back on time. He was a half day out. I don't know what happened to him, but so the wing commander took his place. And or took his place and said, "You know, you must go." So we went. And as I say, it was the second one that the RAF did, and the aircraft were not in any formation the way the Americans did it. We streamed into the target, and aircraft were at varying heights because of the variations in instruments in the altimeters, and because you know their courses were not right on the flight path, as you know, put down on the map. So they were coming in at different heights, slightly different heights and different angles, and going for the target. Well, as we were running in, and we had dropped our bombs, and you normally held the aircraft steady until you got your photograph, you see, and then you would pull it away. Of course, I had closed the bomb doors, I was holding it in there, and there was a Halifax ahead of us, and slightly, about almost the same, sort of slightly below. And there were aircraft above us and around us and below and back of us. And one of the bombs from an aircraft above went through the starboard wing of the Halifax. He was about, I suppose, 100 yards or so in front. And the aircraft, of course, rolled because of the lift from the port wing. And the other wing that had been struck, it came off and it was twirling up like an autumn leaf. And then, see, the aircraft, as I said, had rolled and was dropping. And by that time, we were virtually on top of it or above it when it exploded. And we were tossed on our backs, and I had to pull the thing out and rejoin the stream. But as a result of that experience, the wing commander and I wrote up our comments spoke about it at our debriefing, and the subsequent daylights were done on a stream basis where, you see, each group sort of got its aircraft at a set height, set stream, and you came into it in an orderly, more orderly fashion, and that was one of the lessons that we learned from that operation. But those were interesting. They were thought to be, you know, easy targets, and in some respects they were, except that the flak was pretty intense in places, and Germans reacted very strongly officially.
Did you find that the Germans allocated a lot of resources towards defense from...
Well, they did, I see an issue, but then there was, but at the same time, when we operated in that fashion, the fighter aircraft were ranging, you see, they had at lower levels, and they were, in effect, fending off the German fighters, and by that time the Germans were getting a bit tired and they were stretching themselves. So we didn't see as much of the daylight sense as we expected. Circus I expected. Anyway, Boston, that was one of the other interesting operations. Well, the experience actually was the interesting aspect of the operation, as you know, fairly conventional.
What were the main reasons, do you think, the Allies were able to maintain air supremacy?
Well, two real reasons. We had, first of all, a much better training scheme than the Germans. Secondly, we had operational tours that were specified for each command. The Coastal Command is the number of hours that you, you spent, because you know the number of times that you might encounter real opposition, or fewer. The second thing was that with the operational tours, you didn't wear out your people. The Germans didn't have anything comparable, and they kept recycling their people operation. They were on the operations throughout, and ultimately they either wore out or were killed. You read Gallant's book, and a friend of mine, a German friend of mine, Luftwaffe pilot here, he did something like 60 trips before he was shot down by the Russians for the fourth time. So, you know, we had those advantages. And, I suppose the third advantage was from a production standpoint, that our industrial capacity far outweighed the Germans. They were starting to run out of fuel, their strategic materials that were necessary for producing airplanes and engines and so on were diminishing, even though they had access to the Swedish minerals and that kind of thing. So they had to go on a lot of synthetics for their oil. They didn't have the advantages they had. So it is just a question of time. The war would have been won. It's just a question of how long it would have taken for it to finish, and at what cost. Anyway, it was an experience in another sense that in daylight one of the daylights, you could see 1,000 aircraft in the air all at once, and the stream across the channel was just like a stream of traffic. You see one lot going this way, the other coming back. And that's a sight that you'll never see again.
Yeah.
It was a tremendous technological change and a technological experience in terms of the rate and nature of the development of both of the aircraft and the radar and the communications. Techniques. All the airlines and the flying that's done today is an outgrowth of the experiences that we, in a sense, established in those days. And the Bomber Command operations were the most complex of the whole of the war. They required a great deal of organization, a great deal of tactical and strategic application, and of course. It required a great deal of manpower. It was an expensive, costly part of the war. One of the complaints about it was that the cost was too great in relation to what ostensibly was being done. But I'm not sure that that's a sound argument, because the disruption of production German standpoint, was a significant factor. And then when you think in terms of the numbers of men, the amount of material that was required to defend the homeland, when it could have been applied perhaps from their standpoint more effectively either in the West or particularly in on the Eastern Front, was a tremendous contribution.
They were able to allocate their resources to the ground instead of defending the air. They could have made for different.
Well, even in the air, you see the intelligence, and I have a little bit of awareness of that because my supervisor was one of the was the principal editor and architect of the volumes on British intelligence during World War II. And he was telling me that, well, of course, with the, through their intercepts, the Germans had withdrawn aircraft from Italy and from the Eastern Front in order to defend the Germans against us. And you see, that's something that the Russians benefited from. They didn't always like to acknowledge it, but it was certainly a factor in the battle, for example, of the Kursk salient. The production, the disruption of production of the new German tank was considerable. And the question is, would it have made a difference if they had been there against the Soviets? You know, it's something you can't tell, but it was a factor. One that you can't specify in, on a percentage basis or a statistical basis, because there are no way of measuring it.
You could have prevented, you know, less lives being lost by them having to allocate resources to the West.
Oh, that's right.
So that's one way you could have measured it.
But so, as I say, the impact of the bombing offensive was significant, and you know, you don't just have to read Albert Speer to see what he and they felt and considered in terms of counteraction. You know, it was an interesting experience.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for conducting this interview.
Well, no, not at all. I haven't said very much.
You've given great insight into bombing for Europe during the World War II. That's great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for coming.